You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Well, hello and happy new year. Is it too late to say happy new year? I believe it's already 25th of January, but tonight, so probably a little bit late. But this is the first cycling podcast Feminine we've had in the new year. So, you know, I have every right to say it. And joining me today is Denny Gray of the British Continental. Hello. Are you celebrating Burns Night, Denny?
I've missed out on that. My neighbours had an amazing array of whiskies on Burns Night, but I completely missed out. So, yeah, nothing Burns Night related for me, unfortunately.
Oh, no. Do you know what? Actually, though, my mum claims... has only claimed in the last couple of years that we are distantly related to Rabbi Burns.
Wow.
But literally, she has never said that before until the last couple of years, so it's questionable. Joining us today, special guest on the pod, is cycling commentator, presenter, and journalist. Sorry, Rebecca, I'm giving the build-up. Rebecca Charlton.
Thank you so much.
Actually something there which actually I've seen you do before, where you're giving someone a really big intro and then you're about to mess up their name, which I remember when you were introducing Sophie Hercombe of Cycling News, and you gave her a big build-up and then you said Sophie Hercombe. So it never made the cut.
To add context to that, I've been a friend and colleague of Sophie Hercombe for about a decade, so yeah.
I was just saying the words that I almost
Did you rehearse my name just to make sure?
In my brain. Well, I do edit your showreel, don't I, sometimes, Rebecca? So I know you've got to say cycling presenter, commentator and journalist. But nice to be all together. And I was going to say it's the first time we've been together, but it's actually not, is it? Because only a few weeks ago, we were all in a McDonald's on Wandsworth Roundabout at about 4 in the morning. So
we were.
For the listeners' benefit, we should explain that Becca and I are sharing a mic. She shoved the mic in my direction at that point. But yeah, there was a bit of a soiree of cycling journalists, wasn't there, before Christmas? And we ended up in a karaoke bar and then a McDonald's. I don't know if there's anything more we want to add about that.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, obviously, Denny, you were a singer-songwriter, weren't you? And so I was expecting a lot of the karaoke. I know I've given a bombshell to Becca and probably the whole audience.
I literally did not know this.
But so we were expecting big things of Denny. Denny chooses Park Life, right? He's waiting his turn, seeing it go up and up in the queue as everyone else takes theirs. And then another cycling journalist, not going to be named, steals the mic, absolutely destroys the song with yelling, and Denny's just standing in the corner there looking so upset that his Time to Shine singing Blur was totally ripped away from him.
I tell you what, I've never felt so loved at that point, Rose, because actually I think you looked devastated. You were so annoyed.
Well, the problem was, everyone else was like...
Everybody else was entertained.
Everyone else was loving it, so I was kind of like... on your side, Denny, so I was looking cross as well.
I have to interject at this point, because you two don't know this big reveal. I've got this moment on camera. I videoed the look between the two of you, and then I have you on camera, Rose, asking me to stop recording you, putting the camera in your face. It's saved on my phone forevermore.
And we are actually only just around the corner from that very McDonald's, aren't we? We're just in the Alma in Wandsworth, and they very off Old York Road. They've very kindly turned the music off in this little section to let us record the pod. So we do need to get on with doing that. But I should say, I know lots of people have been asking about Orla and where she is. Orla is just a very busy woman. She'll be back on in no time. She assures me that she's going to try and be back on next month, which would be great to hear from her again. Of course, you know, we will miss having her. And Lizzie Banks also, for personal reasons, Lizzie has had to step away for the time being. But it does mean the shuffle around does mean that we get to hear some new voices. Becca, no pressure, Becca.
I just feel like I should apologise at this point. You've got me.
No, well, luckily, we're coming to something that you should have been paying attention to, and that is the Tour Down Under, because were commentating on that. So hopefully you're paying attention. Obviously, that kicked off the Women's World Tour season for the year. Started obviously stage one, sprint finish for Ali Wollaston. Stage two, a Cecilia Jutrup-Ludwig win, which was kind of, yes, maybe came out of the blue a little bit. But and stage three, Sarah Gigante, which we heard you after Sarah Gigante's win, we heard you and Marty nobly pushing on, even though you were so very emotional about Sarah Gigante and her post-race interview.
Yeah, so what you're referring to here is Rose, you're saying that I was very emotional and you were holding back the tears.
Yeah. That's what we heard, yeah.
You were questioning if I was being authentic with my level of emotion, and I would just like to clarify that I was. And I was speculating on the fact that perhaps because I'd commentated for three nights through the night and then couldn't really get any sleep in daylight hours, I was so sleep deprived and so taken aback by the victory of Gigante that I was genuinely welling up, pretty much crying in the commentary box. So that is true. It is true.
It is no surprise though, because she was welling up. She was very overcome with emotion, so much that I had no idea what she said in the post-race interview, to be honest. But she was very overcome with emotion, and she was saying, you know, that everyone had kind of, it's very hard when you're so young and everyone thinks that you're washed up,
yeah.
that she you know, finally got this result again, actually at the race which she kind of made her name in the first place.
Yeah, and we joke, but it was emotional. And yeah, at the moment, anyone crying in an interview definitely sets me off. But yeah, I think just something we'll delve into more is the context of that win, and the fact that I think she knew exactly what she could do actually on that day, not least because she had that Strava segment, the massive sign there confirming it, just to overcome so many setbacks. And I think that's what genuinely gripped us in that moment, was seeing her realise that.
We've talked about this off air, but it's a bit of a tale of redemption in some cases. Obviously she's had a tough couple of years,
which is great. She's so young.
She is. I mean, we talk about the fact that, yeah, she felt washed up, but she's only 23. But she came to our attention so young, didn't she? And I think the danger is when a cyclist is so young that you think their trajectory is just only going to go upwards from there. And clearly she's had a really tough couple of years, as you said, Becca, with health issues. And, you know, there were issues in her team. She felt she wasn't getting raced last year. And I think it's really interesting because it comes at a time when there seems to be a trend, more so in men's cycling, but also in women's cycling, we've seen the signing of five kind of 18-year-olds at Lidl Trek, of kind of looking to youth. But I think, you know, we always see this kind of non-linear kind of trajectory of progression in women's cycling in particular, and you know, Annemiek van Vleuten was a case in point a couple of episodes ago. I think it goes to show that the team environment, the kind of mental environment of a rider, has so much kind of influence on their perspective on life, and she seems to have really found her feet at AG Insurance.
And there was definitely a pressure, wasn't there, like you kind of touched upon, Becca. She had like the Strava segment on that Wollongong Hill, so everyone was really looking to her. So I imagine for her also it was emotional, being like, if I'm ever gonna win anything, I've got to win this.
Yeah. And I think, going back to what you were referring to there, Denny, is you sign for a team like Movistar in the World Tour ranks and you think, I mean, what an amazing moment. And everybody's looking at you saying, well, this is the big break. This is it. You're riding with the likes of Annemiek van Vleuten, but then you're not fielding races. And I think that is something typical across men's and women's cycling, is that what is perceived to be a rider's biggest career opportunity can unfortunately often stifle them when there's so many talents already in that squad. And going back to the setbacks as well, I mean, how she dealt with that mentally must have been just absolutely massive behind the scenes, mustn't it?
Yeah, and I was trying to think of other riders that kind of, you know, have had these moments where they've seemed like they're kind of washed up and kind of come back and got results. And it's quite hard to find someone who's that young is very hard, I think. I mean, the only person I could that really came to mind was like Marianne Vos, which sounds absurd. But I remember last year I was listening back to kind of our archived episodes of when me and Orla and Richard were doing the women's tour years ago. And we were kind of commenting then, you know, on, you know, Marianne Vos, she's kind of overtrained. I think it was like 2015, kind of that kind of time. She's overtrained and she hasn't got, you know, she's not getting the result and she's had a few injury setbacks and she's just not coming back to the level that she should be, which is total, in hindsight now, is just totally ridiculous that she's come back. And obviously recently she's also been hampered by more surgery and injury. But, you know, she's got so many more results since that. And also Marta Bastianelli, she also had kind of a low time but also was popping babies out. So it's kind of a bit more understandable. But yeah, I was trying to think of other riders who would have been in that situation.
Yeah, and as you say, it does sound sort of ludicrous knowing now what she's come back to do, Maya Boss. I was working with her and seeing her quite frequently during that time where she was off the bike, because of course she was able to take media commitments that she wouldn't otherwise have been able to do when she was racing. And, you know, that was the narrative, wasn't it, stacked against her, was that, oh yeah, she's done, she's absolutely done, which, you know, is another thing that we see frequently in this sport, which is so negative, is just absolutely writing people off overnight, despite everything she had done in all the different disciplines she'd done it in. But talking about sort of specifically young riders and that narrative of, you know, we keep going back to the quote from Sarah Giacante, don't we, saying like washed up, because, you know, just thinking how young she is.
We should say that's Sarah's quote, not our quote.
yes, sorry, that's Sarah Giacante's quote about herself, that people were saying that she was washed up. We certainly have not agreed with that in any way. I was thinking back, and this shows how long I've been in cycling journalism, but Danny Rowe.
Beryl Burton.
Beryl Burton from my era. No. Danny Rowe, no kidding. I was having to even fact check on this when I was thinking about this comparison, because again, it's quite a hard one to believe with everything she's racked up across the track and road. But in the Olympic cycle coming up to London 2012, some people might remember that she spent 2 years off the GB cycling squad. And in that time, was training on her own with that dream that she was going to make it to the Home Olympics. And at that point, there was, I mean, not only no guarantees that she was going to be in that team pursuit setup, but that narrative was perhaps you're not cutting it, perhaps you're not going to get there. And she had that belief for, you know, the duration of 2 years that she could train herself and have enough. Yeah, it just comes back to that self-belief when nobody else is backing you, but you're saying, do you know what, I know that I've got this in me. I'm not going to give up on that dream, and I'm going to keep going. And obviously the rest was history. She came back into the squad, I believe 2012, secured victory at home games. And I think what got me very emotional at the end of the Tour Down Under was that it transcends sport. It truly does, because how many of us have been told in our chosen fields or sport or passions outside of that you just need to give up because it's not going to happen, it's too difficult. And for me as well, just trying to break into the media and then wanting to be a broadcaster, so many people say, well, everyone wants to do it, everyone wants to be a pro cyclist, everyone wants to be in front of the camera, good luck with that. Yeah. And people do write you off. And I think to look at stories like Danny having 2 years, and that must have been tremendously difficult at points, to think, am I going to make it? Is all this work going to pay off? And it ultimately did for both of those riders.
For me, it's partly also a reflection of just how disposable riders are at times. You know, they have short contracts generally. There is a trend now to contracts being slightly longer. But often when you're signed as a Neo Pro, you may have one where you have 2 years, maybe three if we're lucky, and it's a very short window in which you need to prove yourself. And it's very tempting for a team to look at the next generation coming through, or a rider that's got the results in the bag from the previous season, rather than put faith in a rider that may have had difficulties for a season or two. I think for me it's a lovely story, because there must have been a sliding doors moment there where she could easily have not got a contract, or things could have worked out slightly differently, and that must happen all the time in cycling. There are many riders that have never had their moment on Willunga Hill, kind of raising their arms, you know, because they've been dismissed by their team and their mental health's gone on a downward spiral and so on. So it's, I think for me, it's all the more a positive story because of that, and because of that fragility in the cycling world. You know, their careers are so short.
Yeah,
they need to make it matter.
Yeah, it's nice to see that you're tearing up as well, Denny. As well, I don't know whether it's the couple of pints that you've had, or whether it's the emotion of the moment. But I can see you getting glassy eyed. But it's interesting actually to talk about Sarah Giacante and then talk about we know who won the stage before, and that was Cecily Uttrup-Ludwig, because it's interesting because a lot is expected of Cecily Uttrup-Ludwig all the time, and I think in some ways she almost has the opposite problem, where people are always expecting her to win, but actually she might not be quite the right rider to win as much as people think that she's going to. And so I think people are, you know, always delighted when she wins, because she's such a passionate kind of advocate and ambassador for the sport. But she doesn't win as much as people think.
Maybe she doesn't win as much as you think. I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean, she's had a few wins. I mean, I think, yes.
But she's constantly, I think whenever she's like in that kind of small group and she's going up against the likes of Elisa Longo-Borghini and Demi Vollering, whatever, people are always kind of thinking that she... And, you know, it's a bit like what I think with Kasia Niewiadoma as well. I mean, obviously, Kasia Niewiadoma has actually won less than Cecily Ludwig in recent years, but they're both kind of, or have been, punchy riders that people expect a lot from, but actually there's probably not as many races that is going to suit them where they're going to be able to get the upper hand on the likes of Demi Vollering or on previous years, Annemiek van Vleuten. I'm just justifying what I said there. And go, Denny, roll with that.
Well, I don't know. I don't really know what to say to that. I mean,
so you think that she wins as much as you think she should win?
Well, I think your point was more that she has a lot of expectation on her.
Yeah,
you think
I think
people expect her to win more than perhaps she does.
Yes.
Which may be fair, and I guess she's also on a team where she does carry a lot of the leadership responsibilities, and therefore they pin a lot of hopes on her, which also carries a lot of pressure. But you're right; it's different to the situation where. Kind of a rider. She's not in danger of being flicked by her team at any moment. She has a different kind of pressure. But to answer your point, I think she won the Tour of Scandinavia last year. Am I right?
No, she didn't
wrong,
win the Tour of Scandinavia. Annemiek van Vleuten won the Tour of Scandinavia.
Well,
she almost
terrible.
She should have won the Tour of Scandinavia.
She should have won it, shouldn't she? She'd lost it.
Go.
Well, there we go. Maybe you're proving my point.
No, she lost out by, she won two stages, but she didn't win overall.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you. Well, yeah, I don't know what to say to that, really.
We didn't really get to see Cecily Ludwig against her usual European rivals, though, did we? Because the fields that get sent to Tour Down Under are slightly different, like you don't have SD Works there. So it's a slightly... So although she got the win, I think that would mean a lot for her. I don't know whether it means much for the rest of the season, I think, is what I'm also trying to say.
No, I mean, I really enjoy these early season races because they do give you clues and pointers as to what's going to happen in the season ahead. But clearly riders arrive in them in different kind of levels of form. You know, some may have had good winters, some may less so, some may be targeting races later on in the season. So we can't tell a lot, but nonetheless, I think it is a good sign for her to get that early win. I'm sure it'd be great for her confidence. You're right, I don't think we can read too much into it in terms of what she's going to be like when she faces kind of stiffer competition.
And we have seen, obviously, like you said, you know, enjoy these early races because you also get a few different names out there. And one of the most catchy names in the peloton has got to be Ninka Vinka, who came second overall. We were actually, before we started recording, having a debate about how to pronounce Ninka Vinka, but it is Ninka Vinka, isn't it, Becca? You're the commentator. That's what you were saying.
I would like to say with confidence that I believe, I think it's Ninka Vinka.
I've literally, since seeing her, because it was a very quiet win, quiet second place. It's not like we saw her up there a lot and there was kind of a lot of attention was pulled to Sarah Gigante and her result. But literally since it happened, it's just like, to me, like Ninka Vinka, it's like a winner-winner chicken dinner.
It's so just
now,
cemented in our minds
when
now,
I go around my house, I'm just thinking like, Ninka Vinka, wash the sinker.
Utterly delighted to confirm that is in fact how you say her name, because we enjoy saying it. It just rolls off the tongue so well, doesn't it, Ninka Vinka?
And what do you mean,
also a brilliant result.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's yeah. But yeah, she's a real young talent, isn't she? I think she's like 19 years old, and you know, I hope, Denny, that we'll be saying Ninka Vinka for many. Ninka Vinka, I'm trying to think of another one. I can't what a stinker, but that not what a stinker, because she did really well. But it just stays in my head, Ninka Vinka.
We need suggestions from listeners about rhymes of Ninka Vinka.
I was thinking, actually, instead of doing cryptic criterium, I could do like a quiz where it's all based on, you have to say Ninka Vinka, then something that rhymes. But it's in development, listeners. It is in development, trying to work out how to do it. But yes, we want more Ninka Vinka suggestions. That's absolutely right.
And other names like Ninka Vinka as well. I think more rhyming.
Yeah, more rhyming names.
But anyway, to get back to her actual performance.
Would be good, yeah.
Yeah, she's only 19, obviously, with DSM Firmenich post-NL. As they're now called. Well, this is, I guess, one of the reasons I love these early season races, because for her, this was a real breakthrough result. She said after the race that she hadn't really had many opportunities to ride for herself as yet. She's only in her second season as a pro, of course. But this was, I think, the team rode for her on that final stage. And she really got to prove herself. She's obviously a bit of a climber. She came seventh in the Tour de l'Avenir last year, performed really well on the mountain stages. But she also has a cyclocross background, and she was third in the world's junior road race in Australia. So Australia's obviously a happy hunting ground for her. Mm. She's one of those riders that I guess will now keep tabs on, not just because of her lovely name. You know, obviously one to watch in the mountains. She's only 19, and I guess obviously Dutch riders have an amazing heritage in women's road racing. So there may be, talking about pressure, it'll be interesting to see whether there's now a bit of pressure from her amongst the Dutch press.
I love how she just got a second place at the first race of the season, and Denny's like, pressure, put the pressure on her, come on, Ninka. It's part and parcel of being from those nations, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and it was, it was a tremendous performance at such a young age, so people will expect a lot of her now.
Ali Wollaston, we haven't spoken about, won the first stage, a great sprint for her. She is a Kiwi rider, a rider from New Zealand. And when she won, I was kind of thinking, like, it's funny that we have this crop of fantastic riders from New Zealand at the moment when, I remember kind of 10 years ago, there really were hardly any riders at all. So that kind of got me thinking. And this is something that we're going to do all year on the Cycling Podcast, actually, a bit of a new thing where we're going to do a mini feature for each episode with something that's kind of piqued our interest. So I went off to find out a bit about why there was suddenly this new generation of New Zealand riders that were all doing so well, what the reasons behind and why they weren't there before. So have a listen to this.
Yeah, at some points cycling really grows and we get a lot of recognition. At some points it's quite difficult, especially with the racing scene there. I think a few years ago when I went home to New Zealand, no one could really fathom the fact that I could do this for a living. Even now, sometimes I go back and I say I'm a cyclist and they don't really understand. But for sure I notice as we get more numbers in the professional ranks, people more and more understand what I do.
With rolling hills, mild climates and good roads, New Zealand should be a rider's dream. But as SD Works' Niamh Fisher-Black alludes, for a long time, the distance, both in terms of geography and cycling culture, between New Zealand and the traditional racing heartlands couldn't have been greater. The nation has never landed a podium finish at a senior-level World Championships road race. And, unlike neighbours Australia, it's never had a UCI women's team. But right now, there are more Kiwi riders at World Tour level than ever before. Among them, Tour Down Under stage winner Ali Wollaston, Human Powered Health's Henrietta Christie, Ella Wiley of Live Alula Jayco, and Michaela Harvey of UAE ADQ.
And basically, since I was 13, I've been racing a bike doing that. And yeah, I just fell in love with it. And I was doing the scene in New Zealand, which was, it's always been quite small, especially compared to what it's like overseas in Europe. I really, like when I first went to Europe, I really realised how huge cycling is over there compared to New Zealand. So it's always been quite the challenge coming from like small town New Zealand.
It was a challenge Michaela's father Patrick met head on. No infrastructure, no problem. And so came about the Black Magic Women's Cycling Team.
This was back in 2015, 2016, I think we started. There was a little bit of racing around at a club level, but it was always a few, one or two women mixed in with the usually masters men. Yeah, there was basically just club racing. Schools racing is really big in New Zealand, so at least they had that. And then sort of there was a big gap. Well, I suppose it was Michaela what drove it, obviously, with being our daughter. But we made that decision to put our feet in the water and form a women's team, race locally. Interesting enough, once you start to do that, it generates more interest and you got more teams getting involved. So that series here locally went from 10 to 15 riders right the way up to 50 to 60 within a couple of years. So that was really cool locally, but pretty quickly as well, we saw that it still wasn't enough, so we needed racing overseas. Definitely when we first got involved, the racing in Australia was really good, so they had a series called the National Road Series. We identified that pretty much straight away. We went there in our first year and we turned up from a race here where we have maybe 20, 30 riders, and we went to Australia and there was 100 women on the start line. So it was like, wow, this is awesome.
Training and racecraft are a small part of Patrick's vision. More important is exposing young Kiwi talent to races on a bigger stage. with all roads ultimately leading back to Europe.
So if we can get riders to Europe and get them exposed, and what we hope, you know, we send maybe 8 riders across, even if we get 2 or 3 of them, that they have that light bulb moment and they go, wow, this is an amazing sport, it's so exciting, I love it. That's what we're trying to ignite, if you like. That's what happened with, I suppose, my Michaela, Neve, Kim Kirtzell reasonably recently. It's like, she was a great example. I saw her at a local race, once again, like 10, 15 people, and I thought, oh man, she's talented. She's from our local area, and she was a triathlete and was just dabbling in it. And I said, hey, there is actually this career opportunity. You can actually become a professional in this. And I could see even then she had a light bulb moment, and then we got her across to, with us to Australia, and then with Torelli and a couple of things in Europe, and then yeah, that's where she's gone, has driven her passion even further.
Kim Kadzau is now at EF Education Cannondale team, battling it out against Annemiek van Vleuten and Cecily Uchup-Ludwig at the Tour of Scandinavia last year. There's an undeniable growth of Kiwi talent. But even a decade ago, homegrown New Zealand racers were thin on the ground. Joe Kiesanowski was one of the few who made it, despite no clear pathways or permanent funding, enjoying an 11-year career on the road, riding for teams like TIBCO.
I went to the US first, and I was a track racer first, and then I started doing crits while I was over there. Just, you know, it was something else to do along with the track racing. And then after a couple of summers in the US, I got my first pro contract for a road team. It was just racing in the US, and then it wasn't until a couple of years into that that I went over to Europe. And it's actually kind of a cool story. It was Sarah Ulmer, who was, you know, definitely somebody I was looking up to when I was racing. And I got to race with her on the national team. And so there was a few of us, and we had this idea that we wanted to go to Europe and, you know, show that we could be a national team racing in the World Cups. So I think there was like some deal, like that if we got in the top 25 at a World Cup, then we would get funding for the next year. We had to prove that we, you know, could race with the world's best. And I think we got like, I got in the top 25, I got like 23rd or something, and I think Sarah got like 22nd. It was something like this, so we were just like ecstatic because we were like, oh my gosh, we're gonna be able to race here next year. It was such a cool thing that we did, and we got national team funding, and we, you know, did all the big World Cups in 2004 over there. And yeah, so that's how it kind of started. And then I got my first European pro team after Athens, so in 2005.
Despite the highs when opportunities came her way, Kiesanowski's time away from home as a young racer wasn't without challenges.
Not many people, yeah, could do it how I did it, I think, you know, when I did it. And that's why, because it was quite daunting. Yeah, it was not easy for sure, you know, back then. The first year that I went to the States, so 99, 2000, you know, and literally, like, I would have to do, like, you know, payphone, like, on the corner somewhere, like, you know, collect calls back to New Zealand. And then even when I was on my first Italian team, I would have to go to like the bookstore in the little Italian village where I was living and ask them if I could plug in my laptop to use their dial-up so I could check my AOL. You know, you tell, like, you know, your nieces and nephews, or even my girls on the team, you tell them that, and they'll be like, what the hell, how old are you, you know?
Now, though, as the community of Kiwi riders grows in Europe, cyclists can enjoy more of a home away from home.
Definitely, when I sort of followed Michaela into Bigler and things, we had already a lot of camaraderie just as fellow Kiwis. But also, I think anyone can say between their national teammates, they have competition, and in a nice way, because obviously we've also been teammates. So it's nice to have each other in the bunch these days.
There are still challenges. This can't be overlooked. National funding is structured around Olympic sports, and there's lots of red tape involved in organising bike races in New Zealand. However, what can't be understated is the influence that live streams of races has had in bringing the sport to a new audience of potential young racers on the other side of the world.
You often see it in all factors of life. You know, if you see one person do it, then it's sort of like it opens something in your mind that it's possible. And I think for me, definitely, I saw people like Georgia Williams and Michaela Harvey that they could do it. And so then I thought, so I can do it. At one point, it may seem impossible, but I think the more of us that do it, it makes people realise that it is possible.
And this current crop of elite Kiwi riders hasn't forgotten the pathway that helped them on their journey to the World Tour.
I mean, you know the sport really well. It's a hard sport. It's a really hard sport. So it's got lots of ups and downs. So seeing them when they have their good moments and cherishing those and being able to sort of share in that excitement as well. Like, we're really lucky with the likes of Neve, Michaela, Kim, Ella, and so on, that they always sort of come back and talk to us and share with our riders their experience, and that's really cool too.
New Zealand's physical distance from the racing heartlands of Europe won't ever change, but social media has brought them closer than ever before.
Great that people can, you know, look up to their idols, you know, like Need Fisher Black and Michaela and Henry and Ellie and, you know, whoever else is racing at the moment. Yeah, it's just great that they can, you know, follow along and obviously have that as a dream, that they can be a pro cyclist, that you can actually make it a, you know, a viable career.
That was the first of this year's little mini feature from the Cycling Podcast Feminan, which we're going to hopefully do every month, a bit of a deep dive. Maybe I'm selling it too much to say deep dive, shallow dive into a particular kind of topic that piqued our interest, but that was about New Zealand rides. And the thing, the overall message I think that really came through to me, that sort of surprised me, was that the great thing that these New Zealand riders have benefited from was not kind of a better pathway, though of course Patrick Harvey's doing great things at Black Magic Women, nor is it cheaper flights or more financial backing, but it's more the inspiration. It's the fact that the riders can actually watch on demand all of these races. They can actually see that there's a pathway, a career, that there is a peloton of hundreds of female riders that are racing at the top level. And that kind of just made me think how important it is that we, yeah, keep pushing for, like, you know, live race coverage and, you know, professional, decent race coverage as well.
Yeah, I think that really struck me, actually, is the fact that it seems like something not even worth talking about sometimes,
but actually became
the biggest factor, didn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you feel like the world's getting smaller. And I think something we've also nodded to earlier in the podcast is that we are seeing such young riders signed by the World Tour teams now. And you do forget the really obvious things, like they... You know, especially from that part of the world, are going into an environment away from every family member, every friend, and they're plunging into, you know, sometimes teams that are speaking a different language entirely. And I think it's easy to underestimate how, if I think back to being, you know, a 20-year-old and how I might have felt, if you said, right, to pursue your profession, you are going to have to leave everything you know. Mm. And things like the ability to FaceTime or, you know, WhatsApp call, video call, whatever, that, you know, so many resources now to actually be able to keep in touch. And, you know, collectively we know how hard we have pushed for so long to have better race coverage, and it's clearly making the difference, isn't it?
There still aren't huge amounts of riders from New Zealand in the professional peloton, but they have to say that. But I also wonder, I mean, whether the language does play a role as well. You know, increasingly, one of the, you know, it's very obvious when I went to the Tour de France fan with you, Rose, you were there, Becca, too, of course. last summer, you know, it was an English-speaking peloton, and that must help enormously as well as a rider from New Zealand. You haven't got to overcome the same language hurdles that other riders may have to overcome.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I did actually mention, we didn't put it in the feature, but I did speak to Patrick Harvey about that. Like, you know, what is the big difference between New Zealand and Australia? Mm. And, you know, he said... You know, Australia, they've had a really funded, well-funded national program for many, many years, which turned into then the kind of Orica, Jayco thing that it is now, Team Bike Exchange team that it is now. And, you know, they most often field a very Aussie-focused team. And obviously some Kiwi riders have benefited from that in the past. But, you know, that's how they're getting a number of Australian riders competing in Europe, where all the big races are.
Yeah, I'm sure that program helps. And obviously, I know that in the past, the Australian Institute of Sport have kind of funded riders to race abroad and get exposure with other teams and riders and races and so on. I mean, obviously, New Zealand have a great track record on the track. They were second in the team suit just in Glasgow a few months ago. But interestingly, I think it's only Ali Wollaston, who's kind of a prominent rider in the World Tour. So, you know, that
they... I did actually look up Ali Wollaston's route, because she wasn't a black magic woman person.
Right.
And her school has a world-class velodrome in its backyard. Wow. So no surprise that she became a track rider.
Talking of black magic cycling as well, I was just also struck by some of the brilliant names of some of the teams. I was looking at the results from the Gravel and Tar La Femme, which is the only UCI road race in New Zealand. And amongst the teams, apart from Black Magic Women's Cycling, were Green Monkey and Black Dirt Collective. So I don't know. I mean,
they're good, aren't they? Yeah, they're all colours, though.
They are colours. I mean, obviously, black is the kind of,
I guess the New Zealand
colour
of
the national team.
All blacks,
but anyway, top marks for team names.
Well, the Ninka Vinka team is to be commanded, or the winner-winner chicken dinner team. That's even better.
Definite will be theme of the podcast. I haven't done any extensive research into fun names. Sorry, Denny. Sorry, Rose. I think something we are actually having a little chinwag off pod about was the fact that sometimes a track squad, when it comes to Olympic development, can be so prominent. But actually, beyond that, if you're not in that, like mentioning Danny earlier, if you're not in that setup for the track, sort of where do you go from there? And I think sometimes we think that the progression is perhaps better than it is. But as you say, Australian cycling is just so, you know, world renowned, isn't it? They've got such good development. But I've closely followed the progression of Zwift Academy, and I've been sort of covering that since the first year it took place. And everyone had their heads turned and said, wow, like seriously, this is what the culmination of this is, that you get to step straight into the World Tour, having put out amazing power data, and that's what you win at the end of it. You know,
and Ella Harris is a Kiwi rider who came through that, didn't
and
she?
Ella, and as you say, Ella Harris won that, stepped into Canyon Tram. And what that has done has been huge for riders from that part of the world. And sort of segueing onto Australian cycling, I interviewed Neve Bradbury when she won Zwift Academy. And it was the first time, and again, it sounds so obvious saying it back now, but at the time, it wasn't something I'd given a huge amount of thought to. And she said the biggest thing is, you know, everything is happening in Europe. And imagine, and she, again, a very young rider at the time, or still very young, but when she won it, even younger. And saying, you know, how daunting a prospect it is for a teenager to say, well, how do I get the Palmares that's going to turn the heads of the World Tour team if I can't even field races in Europe? And that's why I think we've seen so much success from that part of the world, New Zealand and Australia, in, I guess, just prioritising, actually targeting Zwift Academy as their route over to Europe and the World Tour.
And there are also those other methods that have also come across. But it's all part of that kind of notion of the world becoming a little bit smaller and a bit more connected, isn't it? That you also have kind of the Canyon SRAM generation team that is finding riders from, you know, Jamaica, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and also, you know, riders that don't have the normal pathways in Europe to find these talents and you know, help them come through, have a development team that they wouldn't have in their own countries, which is key. Now, another thing also that Patrick Harvey touched upon was also kind of the lack of racing that there is in New Zealand. And, you know, he also said to me that is one of their greatest challenge is trying to hold these races when there's a lot of regulation in New Zealand and it's expensive and people don't want to have their roads closed. And that's kind of also just demonstrating also a kind of a global trend, isn't it? It's really hard for races to continue on in a really difficult climate where there isn't the money swashing around. I wish there was ever money swashing around, but you know, there really isn't at the moment. And that's kind of one thing that we've seen with Sweet Spot, who are the organizers of the women's tour. We just had it announced last week, I think, that they were entering liquidation and admitting that its liabilities are likely to extend way past £1 million, which obviously, to put it mildly, puts the women's tour, particularly this year, in a very, very, very bleak position. Denny, I know you've been following this story very closely, actually, part of you know, being part of British Continental, it's obviously a key part of your calendar. Not to make any sense. I know, it makes me sound like you're just sitting at home all the time waiting for a bike race to happen. But what I mean is
that's exactly what happens. <for us. laughs>
But you'll understand how key it is for not just the, obviously it's, we'll get on in a minute about how key it is for women's cycling to have the women's tour, but how key Sweet Spot as an organisation has been to cycling in the UK.
Pretty much. I mean, beyond, and I'm going to get that the name to it. Is it marathon events that run Ride London? But beyond them, and Colin Clues, a man who organises the Rutland Melton Cycle Classic. It's a 1.2 men's race, which is a brilliant race in its own right. But beyond that, Sweet Spot have been the UCI race organisers in the UK for many, many, many years now. And not only that, they've organised the tour series of Criteriums, which has been on terrestrial television. So they've been absolutely fundamental to bringing road racing to a British TV audience, bringing road racing to the streets, engaging young fans, and providing a showcase for cycling in the UK. With Sweet Spot kind of on the edge, things do look quite bleak at the UCI level for British road racing. It will only be if the women's tour, and there is still an if.
Where does the if come from there, Denny? Because obviously if the Sweet Spot is in liquidation, you know, who would take up the mantle to...
Yeah, so from what I understand, so Sweet Spot own the rights to the Women's Tour brand, but the talking to people behind the scenes, the dates are still there for the Women's Road Race in the UCI calendar. There's nothing to stop another race organiser, British Cycling, coming forward to try and put on another race. And I know British Cycling have said publicly that that's what they're trying to do to try and make that happen, but of course we're only 6 months away. It's the 5th of June is when it's supposed to start, so there isn't long to get venues in place, sponsors in place, all the logistics you'd need in place to organise a, you know, a Women's World Tour event with all the requirements that you'd need for that. So it's a big ask, you'd think, but talking to people behind the scenes, things aren't completely kind of written off at this stage, and I guess we'll hear in the coming days and weeks whether anything will happen on that front. But in terms of the impact, I mean, yeah, I've been talking to some of the British teams. We've got six UCI Continental Women's teams now in the UK, two new ones this year. Another, Hess Cycling, have switched licences, so have been added to the canon. And I spoke to Bob Lyons, who manages the Alba Road Development Team, one of the new UCI Continental teams, about the impact it would have on British road racing. I mean, for him, you know, I think what he was saying was that's a big part of your conversations when you're trying to get sponsorship, when you're trying to attract funding. You mentioned the women's tour, but you mentioned the fact that you might be able to race that, be on TV, get all that exposure. Without that around, that, I mean, he said it, so he's okay because he wasn't sure he would get a spot this year. But for some teams who were maybe banking on getting a spot, it could be verging on catastrophic not having that kind of exposure, particularly if you've got agreements with sponsors that, and so on. So it's not looking good domestically, particularly because we've documented it on the British Continental a lot, but because the domestic scene is struggling at the moment. So that's not great. But I mean, Lizzie Deignan has also said that it's not great generally for women's cycling. Mm-hmm. The Olympics is not long after the women's tour, so it would have been a good preparation race for that. And obviously, well, as you both know, because you've been long involved in this, you know, the women's tour had aspirations at one point to become the biggest race on the women's calendar, and it was well respected and well run, and it would be a big loss.
It is so well regarded and has been for so long. It was actually funny when I was like looking up when the first one was in 2014, but they've only had 8 editions. But the impact that race has had is huge, isn't it, Rebecca? I know obviously you've worked on it for many years and have seen firsthand about, you know, how much, you know, it really holds such a great place in the minds of the riders that race in it, because it was kind of a very early adopter of kind of being professional, which sounds like a really stupid thing to say, but in terms of, you know, having it's things like having female, you know, portaloos in the, you know, paddock area where the buses are, and having space and room, and getting the school kids out on the on the roads to come and watch and having the safety elements. It was all before its time in that way.
It doesn't sound stupid at all. It's an absolute game changer in that respect. And I'm going to get all emotional again now. like, as you said, there, this is one really, really close to my heart because I had the great privilege of hosting the TV coverage on ITV for many years. I also, you know, when it comes to working closely with Sweet Spot, I was the lead reporter for the Tour of Britain. I worked again for the ITV TV coverage of the tour series, and
if anyone does want to employ Rebecca,
if anyone
she
would
is
like
available
to
for
talk to me about. No, but I think jokes aside, I was so close to the decisions that they were making at Sweet Spot, and when OVO Energy came on board and we saw parity and prize money and they came out and said, right, we are matching the prize funds for the Tour of Britain, and it was really significant. And I know you were sort of saying, you know, it sounds again crazy to allude to it, but that professionalism was unparalleled at the time, and that's what they bought to the racing. And I think it would be very easy for me, as such a fan of that race, to sort of be biased and to say, oh no, it was definitely the pinnacle. But it was, it undoubtedly was. And as you say, interviewing riders off the record when they were away from any TV cameras would always say the Women's Tour is the most professionally organised, respectful race, things that nobody else thinks about, like we might need to go to the toilet in the start village. You know, that was all catered for, prize money being a huge talking point. And yeah, they did it so well. The riders wanted to come and race it, and we saw, you know, the best bike riders in the world.
Well, it was,
that
I mean,
race.
The first one was the first winner was Mariana Voss, and obviously yeah. Lizzie Dinan, Elisa Longo-Borghini, Demi Vollering. I mean these
huge.
Are riders, not then, you know, it isn't the most you know, big mountain pass type race, but you know, it always attracted the best riders. But I do feel a little bit like it was very hard for it. I think also with, obviously they say, you know, rising tide lifts all boats, you know, having the Tour de France fam come on the scene. Obviously that's not to do with anything to do with necessarily Sweet Spot's problems. It's very hard for it to have its own place and identity when, you know, it can't necessarily offer those huge alpine passes, which is now, say, even 6 years ago, it wasn't really, a big deal. People weren't demanding these huge climbs in races. And obviously there are big climbs in the UK, but not necessarily the ones that will also want to host the Women's Tour. Also struggles a little bit with its identity or what it can offer riders, especially as the big riders in the world are becoming big climbers. Obviously we did have more of that, like the Welsh, big Welsh mountain passes, but in the early days it was quite flat, really, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, if I'd been racing, it would have been fantastic. Yes. I was going to say, like,
just
when
the
Gravesend
cycle
up,
path.
I absolutely aspired, you know, to having a race opportunity like that. So it would have been great for me to field the cyclo park. If it stopped there, that would have been good for me. You've really hit the nail on the head talking about the calibre of riders it attracted, and that really was testament to what was going on behind the scenes, wasn't it? That actually, yeah, the amount of respect for it was absolutely there.
And okay, yeah, it didn't have a kind of the variety of parkour that you might get in the Tour de France Fam or the Giro d'Anne, but nonetheless, it did provide, you know, some really great racing, and there was scope for that to evolve. And I think actually, maybe that would have become or could become if a race on those dates continues its niche. We don't want all races to look alike. So I think that from that perspective, in terms of the terrain it was covering, I think that's fine. As long as you can find a way to kind of engineer exciting races, which is down to the riders as much as the terrain sometimes anyway, as we know. So, yeah, I mean, it would be a huge loss if it disappears. So, fingers crossed, it remains.
Yes, we are all hoping that someone will swoop in and save it. Or maybe, you know, it's off for now and comes back on in the future. But I think it would be really sad to... It's also hard seeing that. Obviously, it was on hiatus last year. It is kind of very rare for a race to do a genuine hiatus that isn't kind of related to a global epidemic, let's say, and then still come back. We kind of saw that with Tour of California. It kind of had hiatus and then it never came back. But we shouldn't, you know, finish on that kind of glum note. And actually, there are, you know, we are getting now into the racing season, aren't we? On the horizon, we've got the likes of Omloop, where we kind of finally see all those riders that have been. Well, I guess because on Instagram you get to see what everyone's doing all the time, don't you? That you can't ever believe it, I guess, is the problem. But we do actually finally get to see, you know, how the likes of SD Works are faring.
Yeah, no, loads to look forward to. I mean, this is the. I think this is one of my favourite parts of the season, actually, just because there's so much anticipation. Dare I say it, speculation.
Denny, you said a minute ago that your favourite part was the very early races. Now you're saying it's just the slightly early races. Then next month it will be the mid-races.
I think I said it's one of the favourite, my favourite part of the season. Okay. I think they're all my favourites, really. But no, I mean, I think well, this is the time when you've gone through the winter. There's been no racing. You've been lamenting the lack of racing on TV, and okay, you might have been watching the cyclocross or whatever else is on, but really you just wanted the road racing to come on. And then by the end of the season you're like, crikey, there's so many races on all the time, I can't wait for it to stop, I need a break. Well, this is like a new year's, when you start the new year and you've got resolutions you've made and things are going well and you've got all this hope and anticipation for the future. That's how I'm feeling right now.
Well, I mean, that's a fantastic sell for the cycling podcast. Come with us on Denny's emotional roller coaster through the season.
This is a highly emotionally charged podcast.
I'm going to blame you, Becca.
For the almost new year, but not new year. I don't believe we've actually mentioned this yet today. It's an Olympic year.
Yes, of course.
How have we not mentioned this yet? I feel like that's my cliche that I've been rolling out in everything lately. But I do think that it's a really interesting one. Loads of riders were saying, and sort of team managers were saying, how people are coming into the likes of the Tour Down Under pinging way more than any other season. And you've got riders that, again, looking at Cecilia Ludwig, people that are looking to where they might be around the summertime of the Olympics. So I think it is even more amazing to see people absolutely on fire very early on in the year with a view to maintaining that and peaking even more later on in the year. But it is an exciting time of the year. Very emotional time.
Apparently.
Yeah, to just throw that in. But I'm excited. But I also think that this, you know, the prevalence of social media is just getting more and more and more in terms of seeing what people are doing in training, but we don't know until we see them race. If you look at my Instagram, I'm ready for a summer of cycling, which is definitely not the case.
I have witnessed you, Becca, get dressed up, then walk to the end of the road, stand with your bike, have a photo taken.
Hang on, Rose, when did this happen? It's not. I want to refute this.
Oh, great ride! Fantastic, really.
Really, is that true? Or are you making that up?
Might be what I. Maybe what I heard.
This is what you perceived my Instagram.
Yes,
to be.
Maybe.
I have ridden my bike a few times this new year,
just for my own self-esteem. Well, anyway, Becca, thank you very much for joining us, and I'm sure we'll see you in the very local vicinity to Wandsworth soon.
In McDonald's. There are other fast food outlets available.
I do think actually that I'm going to make a Google map of all the places that our little tour de Wandsworth, Denny. I'm going to make a little map, and McDonald's will get a special mention on that, of all the places that we've gone, and probably all the ones, what about all the ones that we did at the Tour de France as well, if I can remember them. I'll put them all on a Google map that everyone can follow. We are on Instagram, everybody, so do go and find the Cycling Podcast on there. Yes, but thank you very much, Becca. I hope that wasn't too torturous for you.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it.
Oh, and thank you, Denny, of course.
No, thank you. I mean, I didn't get the introduction Becca got at the beginning. I just have to say that now. No. But that's okay. I'm getting used to that.
No. But yeah. Okay. Now you've heard it here. I'm going to give you a huge introduction next time.
Right, well, I look forward to
that. Embarrassing.
Yeah.
No way.
I'll hold you to that. But anyway, I mean, it's been a lovely episode. We should continue. We should definitely go to the Telegraph pub.
Oh.
Which is the closest pub to the highest point in Wandsworth. So it would be like our little Alp d'Huez. In fact, the highest point in Wandsworth is indeed called the Putney Alp. Which is on Putney Heath. Yeah.
Wow, there you go. Well, find us there next time. Thank you for joining us, everybody.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.